This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll be talking about science policy and bioethics. But first, when the climate changes due to global warming, plants and animals either find a new place to live or adapt over time or just die out. So what does that mean for tropical areas, which are very sensitive to temperature change, and already the plants and animals in there are living in a very warm spot? Writing this week in the journal Science, a group of researchers looked for answers in the tropics of Costa Rica. They studied how ants and moths and shrubs and other tropical plants might deal with increasing temperature. And in their study, they say that the legendary biodiversity of the tropics may be threatened by even small increases in temperature. Joining me now to talk about it is one of those researchers, Robert Colwell. He's a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. He joins us by phone from California. Welcome to the program, Dr. Colwell.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Why did you first tell us where in Costa Rica did you study?
We worked at or out of the La Selva Biological Station, which is in the Atlantic lowlands, basically at sea level, a little bit above sea level, which is a large protected area of old growth forest. But it's connected to a continuous corridor of forest that's Braulio Carrillo National Park that rises from sea level to the top of a volcano, Volcan Barva, at 3,000 meters, about 10,000 feet above sea level. Mm-hmm. So we worked first at La Selva for 10 years on some of these groups, and then for 5 years worked up the mountain on a rough, rugged trail with shelters built along the way to collect data on the distribution of the organisms you just mentioned along this elevational transect.
And it's important to have that elevational transect as you study what happens over time?
Absolutely. In fact, they're very rare things. This transect is the last remaining continuously forested transect between somewhere in Mexico and somewhere in South America. And it's only there because the organization had a public campaign in the 1980s to protect it, and now it's part of the national park system.
Now we've seen in other places around the world that as it gets warmer at sea level, we know it gets cooler as you go up the mountains. Would we not expect the plants and animals to follow that coolness up the mountain down there?
We do expect them to do that if they can. The other side of the same volcano, if you saw a photograph of that, shows what is more typical of tropical mountains, that there's a severe habitat fragmentation, usually for very successful farming activities in Costa Rica for dairy farms and so on. So think of an orchid living in an old-growth tree that somehow has to find its way to a 600 meters higher place in the next century losing track of things. And if there's a gap in the habitat, that's very difficult.
It can't cross the farmland to get up.
Right, across the farmland.
Yeah. So did you find this to be the case, that these species are threatened, these plants and animals are threatened?
Well, we don't have any baseline data for this transect. In fact, there are only two published studies of actual documented elevational movements in the tropics, both from another place in Costa Rica, Monteverde, where by good fortune there were some data from the 1980s that could be compared. So our data will be very valuable in 10, 20 years, but as of now we simply had to conjecture based on the distributions of the species.
And what's your conjecture?
Well, we found that over half of these species, at least for the transect we looked at, the range over which each of these species occurs is so narrow that if the climate zones move up 600 meters, the new range of those species, the projected range, will no longer overlap any part of the current range. So there's a gap between where they're growing now and where they will have to be later on if this happens.
And what kinds of plants are we talking about? What kinds of animals are we talking
about? Well, Catherine Cardaluce of Colgate University was one of our co-authors, and she collected data on 550 species of epiphytes. That would be ferns, orchids, bromeliads, perching plants, things that live in the limbs of trees. And then Alex Gilman of UCLA collected data on ground living shrubs and herbs in the coffee family. Now, these are all native plants, but mm-hmm. in that family, 84 of those species up and down the gradient. So those are the plants that we looked at.
And are there plants that might not be able to move up?
Well, I'm thinking particularly of these epiphytes that yeah. need trees to live in, and yeah. if there are no trees, that makes it a little hard.
Yeah, I can understand that.
But the moth groups that Gunnar Brehm, our co-author from Germany, looked at, these moths are all, their larvae, their caterpillars, feed on particular species of plants. So they depend upon plants moving up yeah. if they're going to be able to move up the mountain. So that's another complication.
Yeah, so it's a whole web, a whole chain that has to move up together.
That's right, and it's not likely to. In fact, each species is likely to move in an idiosyncratic way, some a little more, some a little less. And some of them are wide-ranging, some narrow, more narrow-ranging. So there will probably be a shuffling of communities that actually has been normal in the kinds of up-and-down movements over the glaciation cycles on the Earth. We know that current communities are different than there were during other periods like this.
So what happens to the plants that already are at the top?
Well, the ones that are at the top have nowhere to go unless there's some other population of those same species on another higher mountain. They will be forced to lower and lower fitness and may go extinct.
Wow.
This is the same problem we have in temperate mountains, of course. Mm-hmm. There's another article in the same issue of Science on a wonderful study on Yosemite National Park based on data taken 100 years ago by Joseph Grinnell of the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at Berkeley. And they're able to go back to the very same places and find that overall there's been a shift upwards, but quite varied among different species in how they're reacting. Mm.
Are there people living up at these levels too, as you move up the side of that volcano?
Oh, yes. In fact, the Braulio Carrillo National Park is basically a peninsula of forest surrounded by farmland and forest fragments on each side of it. Mm-hmm. When it was purchased, some of it was farms and has regrown, although there was a core of old-growth habitat.
Might you get non-native plants and pests that move up where they were not and move into places and niches they were not before?
Well, that's possible. I think that's more likely in the lowlands, and that's another concern that we have. The lowlands, of course, are the warmest forests on Earth now. They always are the warmest forests on Earth, the equatorial lowland rainforests. So when it gets warmer there, unless those plants somehow have an ability to tolerate additional warming, which many believe they do, but we're not so sure, unless they have that, those lowland plants will move up if they can, leaving behind perhaps a decreased biodiversity in the lowlands, and possibly key species that are important for ecosystem function may be affected as well.
Mm-hmm. Is this a typical tropical area? In other words, if you're studying this place on this volcano in Costa Rica, can you apply it to other places in the tropics?
Absolutely. I should say to wet forests. I mean, there are different things happen in dry forests, so let's stick to wet tropical forests. Everywhere on Earth it's been looked at, these elevational distributions of these species have very narrow bands of occurrence on these mountains compared to temperate mountains where things are much broader.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything besides, in general, you know, halting global warming around the world, is there anything locally that can be done to mitigate any of this?
Well, the most important thing that can be done is to protect and restore elevational gradients of continuous habitat to provide a corridor for these movements to happen.
And that you're saying to bring back the natural forest to where the farmland is?
That's right, and there's actually some of that was done with this very park. When it was first established, there were some edges, some areas on the edge that were farmland and have now gone into late second growth. The secondary forests in the tropics grow very fast, and if they're near sources of seeds and the right kinds of animals to disperse those seeds, they can often regrow very quickly into habitat that's usable. Even by old-growth forest, the species can go through these forests. Mm-hmm. It's the open areas that are a problem for movements for a lot of birds and mm-hmm. mammals, and of course for insects that depend on the plants. Mm-hmm.
So I guess if you're an environmentalist and you're trying to plan a nature preserve or someplace, you'd like to then keep it to where the forest will stay. So you can
exactly. And you know, for a long time we've been saying, well, we need corridors between Nicaragua and Costa Rica, for example, in the lowlands, which we do need. That's important. But escape by going to higher latitudes is not going to happen for tropical species, because between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, it's basically a constant temperature, constant average temperature. From the tropics north to the poles, it goes down, as you know, to lower and lower temperatures in a pretty straight line way. But between, say, Acapulco and Rio, any beach you go to is going to be the same temperature.
Mm. So what would you like to study next? What do you need to know next?
Well, I would love to see, this is probably not something I'd do myself, but I'd love to see experimental research done, which is very little has been done, bringing plants and other organisms from different points along a single gradient and growing them in the lowlands and mid-elevation and high elevation, and see how they respond to those temperatures. This was done a century ago almost, well, 80 years ago in California, some very famous studies. But basically this has been done, and nothing's been published like that for tropical organisms. Then for animals that are not of ethical concern, for example, like insects, you could do laboratory experiments to see what their tolerances are. People that have done that find that a lot of tropical insects are now living near their upper thermal tolerance right now, which means they're the ones that might be in trouble.
They're right at the – it's as hot as it can get for them right now.
Right. And right now the temperature in the tropics is believed to be within 1 degree of the hottest it's been in the last 2 million years. So if these lowland organisms are retaining their ancestral tolerances from, say, 15 million years ago, they somehow managed to go through all those glaciations and keep them. So, I'm hoping that there are hidden adaptations in these lowland plants that will allow them to withstand these changes.
Good luck to you, Dr. Caldwell, on your search.
Thank you very much, Ira. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You're welcome. Dr. Robert Caldwell is professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut, the main campus of the University of Connecticut. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about science, kind of public policy. And before that, we're going to also talk about deep bacteria. It's one species. Very interesting. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, we're all taught about the web of life, the famous food chain, where animals at the top devour those below them as sources of food. But this week, researchers report that they have found one place, at least, where that kind of interaction just doesn't occur and doesn't need to. They found a bacteria. They found a bacterium that is self-sufficient. These bacteria contain all the tools they need to eat and grow and reproduce, and these bacteria live virtually entirely by themselves in one little spot. Joining me now to talk about it is Dylan Shivian. He's the bioinformatics lead at the Joint Bioenergy Institute. That's part of the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in Berkeley, and he joins us by phone from there. Welcome.
Hello.
Tell us about these bacteria. Where did you find them?
So these bacteria are found in South Africa, and the way they were found was by going into gold mines, going down 2.8 kilometers and drilling into a fluid-filled fracture that's down there. These mines have to avoid blowing into these fractures because otherwise it'll flood the mine. So they carefully avoid them, but they were able to get a shaft close enough that we were able to drill through into it and extract out 5,000 liters of water and filter it out and collect that DNA and sequence it. And so when we did this, we discovered from that DNA that there was really only one organism present in that DNA. It's very exciting.
Wow. So what does it live on?
So it lives on sulfate. So here at the surface, most organisms are going to be dependent on oxygen as a terminal electron acceptor, and so they extract energy by moving electrons from chemicals that, you know, at which they're higher potential, and move them to oxygen, which is greedy for electrons. Well, there's no oxygen down there, and in fact, early Earth, before cyanobacteria changed the atmosphere, there really wasn't any oxygen to speak of. So organisms mm-hmm. had to use and have to use down in the deep other chemical species, in this case, sulfate.
This sounds very much like the kinds of things we hear growing in the bottom of the ocean in those hot climates, you know, where they're living off the sulfate.
That's right. And in fact, one of the things that's sort of special about this genome is that it's managed to assemble the blueprint it needs for a single species ecosystem, partly by combining those genes it's inherited from its bacterial lineage, but additionally it's picked up genes from archaea, these extremophilic archaea. So, for example, the nitrogenase it has is most closely resembles high-temperature archaeal-type nitrogenases, so it can fix nitrogen from the its environment mm-hmm. through that. It also has genes for the sulfate utilization that look like archaeal genes, and also its carbon-fixing machinery. Part of that also looks like that from extremophilic archaea. Mm-hmm. So it's managed to piece together the solution, but it's done it by combining pieces from different kingdoms.
When you say it's done it by combining pieces, does that mean that it once coexisted with these archaea, or was part of them, or a subclass, or lived with them, or came the same time they did? Take a choice.
Yeah, exactly. So it seems like a bit of a conundrum, right? Here it is living by itself, and yet its solution for this ecosystem is combining things from different organisms. Well, the solution here is actually that the ancestor to this organism, Disulfurutus adaxviator, was living in contact with archaea in the past. Mm-hmm. And so that's when those genes made their way into this genome and eventually were brought with this colonizing ancestor into this fracture.
Do we then might believe that they were at the bottom of the ocean in these hot thermal vents too at some point?
Well, so if we look at scraps of marker genes that you can find flowing out of vents and these various surveys that are done, we actually find that there are not exact relatives, but sort of a little bit beyond the genus level relatives mm-hmm. that to Disulfurutus that are coming out of Juan de Fuca Ridge vents and coming from fluid seeps from the Gulf of Cadiz off Spain, and mm-hmm. there's similar relatives in Denmark and in an aquifer in New Mexico.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, it's all over the place. And it gets its energy from the sulfur, but you say it can also fix the nitrogen and the carbon on its own?
That's right.
How long do we think it's been down there?
Well, so it's hard to say. It's fairly diverged from surface organisms, but probably the best minimum estimate would be that isotopic studies of the water date the youngest water, meaning the last time it saw the surface, at least 3 million years, possibly up to 10 million years. So it's probably somewhere in that range, but it's hard to really pinpoint it because we can't, mm-hmm. We don't know the division rate. We don't know, it's hard to measure based on the divergence of the genome without knowing several factors.
So I guess it has no interest in evolving into moving up to the surface anymore.
No, it doesn't really need to. I mean, what it's really found here is you know, there's this concept in ecology of a niche, right? Well, this is essentially a literal niche. I mean, it's perfectly optimized to this one spot. And so it's come and taken it over, and it's really happy right where it is.
Do you think that if you have found this this in this gold mine, it's probably in lots of other places then?
Well, it's hard to say exactly how similar its relatives would be in other locations. You have to sequence the entire genome, and there's a lot of variation even in very close organisms. And we're finding this as we sample more and more from different, like in the ocean, for example. There'll be numerous very, very similar strains at one level, but if you actually go and look at the genome, the mm-hmm. genes that are present in it are quite different, so the capabilities mm-hmm. are somewhat different. So that may be the case here.
Right.
We may find similar organisms throughout the deep subsurface, but the exact content of the genes, the exact abilities of those organisms may be slightly different.
Why is it living alone? Is it because it's the only thing that can survive under those conditions?
Well, it's a very interesting question. It's not quite possible to say right now. One possible explanation is that you would think that, well, it has these gifted genes from, you know, extremophilic archaea. Well, why aren't we finding them there? And one possible explanation is that, well, archaea can't form endospores. This is an ability that's been granted to it from its gram-positive Firmicutes lineage. So it's possible that it's this combination of bacterial abilities and archaeal abilities that mm-hmm. has really given it the ability to survive.
Mm-hmm. And you gave it a very interesting name, and it has an interesting derivative.
Yes. The genus name Disulfur rutus is based on the fact that it uses sulfate for its energy, and then the rutus is the morphology. The shape is a rod-like shape. And then the Adax viator, we were inspired by Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth. There's a message that inspires their journey, which tells them to descend, bold traveler, which in Latin is Adax viator. This is a message given in Latin. So descend Adax viator and you will attain the center of the earth.
Well, that's a very, very good place to end. And thank you very much, Dr. Chivian, for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Dylan Chivian is the bioinformatics lead at the Joint Bioenergy Institute. That's part of the Lawrence Berkeley Lab in Berkeley, California. For the rest of the hour, what does the incoming president, and in that case, let's throw in the incoming Congress, because all of Congress, lots of senators, are up for re-election. What do they need to think about when it comes to science and technology? And how can we make sure that the president has good people to help him think about that? While the economy and the war are certainly at the front of many people's minds this election season, issues like energy policy, healthcare, stem cell research sit at the intersection of science and policy. And joining me now to help us consider some of those issues is Tom Murray. He's the president and CEO of the Hastings Center. That's a nonpartisan bioethics research institution in Garrison, New York. Welcome back to the program.
Hello, Ira. It's good to be speaking to you after so long.
Been a while. Before we begin talking about what the president needs, it's hard to ignore the 800-pound gorilla in the room.
Indeed.
And that is the economy and where it's headed. And I know you're not an economist specializing in this kind of question, but we must take into account, don't we, the fact that there may not be money for lots of these things.
I've been thinking about that continuously. So I think what got you to call me in the first place was this report from the Center for the Study of the Presidency, mm-hmm. the panel in which I sat. It was run by Ann Solomon and Richard Meserve, president of the Carnegie Institution. And you can roughly think about the report's recommendations in two classes, policy for science and science for policy. So thinking in the first now, policy for science, how are we going to pay for the kinds of research that we think is important? How are we going to pay for the publicly funded research through agencies like the National Institutes of Health mm-hmm. that will sort of be the font of innovation for biomedicine and healthcare? It's really a terrible quandary right now.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255, talking with Tom Murray. Okay, let's get into some of these questions about science and policy of science.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see are some of the great issues that we'll be facing the next administration, the next Congress?
Well, if we want to pivot to the issues that we deal with at the Hastings Center, basically bioethics, ethics, mm-hmm. Science, and medicine. There's a long list, but let's we'll mention a few things, but let me begin by asking why bioethics is important in the first place. My friend Nancy Gibbs from Time Magazine was visiting at the center some time ago, and you know her question was, why should anybody be interested in bioethics? I said, well, you should only be interested in it if you care about what happens at the beginning of life, at the end of life and at many, many points along the way. So if you follow me that far, then you realize that bioethics issues are particularly difficult ones politically, because they all of them vary along two dimensions. They vary along the sort of the standard political dimension of interests. There are conflicting interests. Physicians, pharmaceutical companies, and families all have interest in the shape of healthcare reform, because it will affect how much money they make, how much money they have to spend. Parents of children with juvenile diabetes care a great deal about what happens in stem cell research policy. The people who run infertility clinics, which tend to be pretty good profit centers, are very concerned about trying to fend off regulation of assisted reproductive technologies. Folks who are worried about organ shortages, some of them will advocate for markets for organs. Well, of course, market solutions may be a little less popular today than they were a few months ago. And there are areas like synthetic biology, which is an emerging technology that we've recently begun working with, studying at the Hastings Center. So the scientists there are saying, you know, self-regulation is fine. We don't need any help. So that the interest dimension is a pretty common one. But we have a second dimension when you begin talking about bioethics, and that's the dimension of meanings and values. The shape of our healthcare system is really also a judgment about what kind of people we are and what we owe one another. Mm-hmm. Stem cell policy, particularly specifically when you're talking about the creation or use of embryos to make stem cells, means a great deal to many people, the fate of those embryos. Same about infertility clinics. The fact that we don't know the exact number of frozen embryos in the U.S. right now, but as of 5 years ago, we were able to track almost 400,000. Mm-hmm. The numbers are almost certainly much larger than that right now.
Let me just jump in and say, yep. this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, that's good. I didn't mean for this to be a monologue.
I'll jump in there when it's necessary.
All right. I'll just mention the last two again, the idea of trying to increase the supply of organs by providing financial incentives for families to donate organs or by providing markets for living organ donors, like kidney donors. By the way, I trapped myself there. If you sell something, you're not a donor, you're a vendor.
You're a vendor.
Right.
Interesting. Are these issues going to be framed politically and, I guess, socially by whomever becomes president, having a different view from the other person?
Very much so. And the two candidates on many of these have quite different positions. We did a quick track. If anybody wants to go to the Hastings Center's website, and there's a link to it from your website, we were able to find more than 40 bills on bioethics issues in the current Congress. Now, those that haven't been passed will just have to get back in the queue in the next Congress, so this will all restart again in January. Mm-hmm. We found 7 on just cloning and stem cell research alone.
So this election, even though everybody is focused on the economy at this point, will very much have other coattails to it.
Assuredly, yeah. The one that's received public attention in bioethics has been, of course, healthcare reform.
Yeah, yeah, and of course, a lot of people have talked about embryonic stem cell research, as you mentioned.
That hasn't made the debates, at least not as far as
very little science has made the debates.
Yeah, like,
have you noticed that?
I have, and I've been sorry to see that.
And ethics issues are just about, you know, ethics and science just doesn't about exist in any of the debates that have been going on lately. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a call in or two to folks who are eager to talk to us about it. Let's go to Eric in Auburn, New York. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I had a comment about how we can use this economic difficulty to motivate Congress to do things that we might like to see done. I think it would be very difficult to move Congress to do a jobs program and switch us from fossil to a renewable energy economy, but this would start all kinds of industry and be jobs production and get the economy going. We've got infrastructure that needs to be replaced. We should have high-speed internet right to our homes. We should be funding some of the new industry in biotech and other research-related, science-related issues. And I think the listeners here can do a lot simply by calling their congresspeople and encouraging this. It's certainly what I did when they were talking about a bailout.
That's probably been the most important comment about science policy that at least I heard from the various campaigns, and that's been Senator Obama's proposal to sort of rebuild an American industrial economy on green technologies.
Mm-hmm. All right, we have to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Tom Murray and take your questions. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, talking about the science, public policy, and issues like that in the next administration. We still have science, openness, and freedom issues to talk about. Other kinds of issues that you'd like to talk about, as I say, 1-800-989-8255. If you're in Second Life, find us in Science Friday Island. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with Tom Murray, President and CEO of the Hastings Center. That's a bioethics research institution in Garrison, New York. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Tom, let's talk a bit about some of the other big issues facing the presidency, and one that really, I think, has a bioethics edge to it that doesn't get talked very much about is some of these emerging technologies like nanotechnology. You know, the jury is still out on the total health effects, the possible health effects of all these tiny nanoparticles that are floating around.
Indeed. I have a bicycle with me here on Cape Cod right now. It's made with carbon fiber, and I love the bike, but we'd like to know a lot more about the potential health effects of carbon fiber when it's being manufactured and when it degrades and enters the waste stream.
And when you saw into it to customize your bike.
Yeah.
And you create that dust.
Yeah, I'm sure. We've been looking at nanotechnology at the center. More recently, as I mentioned, we've been looking at synthetic biology. Mm-hmm. Have you spoken about that on Science Friday
sure,
at all?
But go
yeah.
ahead.
Yeah, well, synthetic biology is very interesting because it invokes all these questions about the benefits, which are somewhat easier to imagine, but risks, which can be very difficult to really get your arms around.
Such as?
You don't really know how these complex new biological organisms are going to behave. Biological systems are inherently complex and unpredictable, and you don't know what will happen if any of them are released into the general environment. Mm-hmm. Now, the people who are developing them have pretty good, reasonable answers right now. They'll say, well, we'll make them so they're so fragile that they'll be essentially hothouse flowers and they wouldn't survive outside of a laboratory or industrial setting. Mm-hmm. And that's possible, but life does tend to find a way. So we'd want to look at that, look at those problems. But the other thing about synthetic biology that's less talked about, and it's the set of issues that we're particularly interested in, is its meaning for our relationship both with ourselves, if we began to use synthetic biology to remake our bodies and our physiology, and our relationship with nature. These are very tough things to try to articulate, and they're extremely difficult for policymakers to understand how to think about and how to bring into their judgments when they're shaping policy. But we think these are issues that absolutely need to be addressed, and we're hoping to do that soon.
And where do they get their advice on thinking about these things?
That's a good question. That's an empirical question. I don't know the whole answer to, Ira, to be perfectly honest.
The fact that no one knows it answers the question itself.
I'll tell you a couple of quick stories. Years ago, this must have been about 7 years ago, when the new Congress, so it would have been, but it had actually been 2001, I think, when the new Congress was getting together, and the people were still civil enough to one another, that they were able to hold a bipartisan congressional retreat. And I was invited to be one of the experts. They didn't have a lot of them. Maybe had a dozen people from outside of the Congress people, their families, and their senior staff. And I was running a couple of workshops on basically genetics and genetic engineering, biotechnology, and the like, and ethical issues thereof. And after one of the workshops, one of our elected representatives came up to me and said, "You know, can you explain to me what the difference is between a genetically engineered organism and the stuff, the hybrid and hybrids?"
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to, but it was a good thing that he was able to ask that question. But the fact that he's on a committee that has jurisdiction over this and nobody had ever explained that to him was a little frightening. The setting, because it was private, no reporters there, enabled him to ask an embarrassing question that he otherwise might have, just never asked. We need more settings like that. We need more opportunities for policymakers to get valid information and not look like fools while they're doing it.
1-800-989-8255. Mark in St. Paul. Hi, Mark.
Well, to the answer of advisory, you can also go back to the 1980s. I remember while I was in the service, I remember hearing and reading about where Reagan dissolved or disbanded a science advisory council to Congress, saying that Congress can get the proper information from lobbyists. So there was something that was out there. It was nonpartisan, everything, but Reagan said we cannot rely on the lobbyists.
Well, you don't think they can get adequate information from lobbyists? Is that what you're saying?
Well, considering the lobbyists work for industries that want Congress to vote certain ways, probably not.
I'm with you 100%. I should note that in the Center for the Study of the Presidency report, the second recommendation includes a recommendation to create a Congressional Office of Science and Technology Policy. I suspect the body you're talking about was the old Office of Technology Assessment.
Yeah, that's what it was.
There is one thing, a little comment one person was making about complexity of biology. Something most people don't realize, we understand the space shuttle far better than we understand the basic complexities of a single-celled organism. The chemistry goes on there way outweighs or is more complex than most of the space shuttle workings.
That's an excellent analogy. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Mark.
Good day.
It underscores our interest and concerns about synthetic biology.
Yeah, so you can also apply that to we know more about the backside of the moon than we know about the deep oceans.
Yep.
So there's a lot of work to be done, and as you said, as we started out saying, Lord knows where the money is going to come from. There was even talk about even the space program cutting back possible future exploratory missions to Mars and other places because money is tight.
And if you look at the platforms of the parties and the presidential and the policies proposed by the presidential campaigns, there's not much explicit mention of funding for science or science policy in the Republican platform or in Senator McCain's campaign pledges, but Senator Obama does include a significant increase for NIH in his plans. Mm-hmm. Now, what the fate of that will be in the light of the looming economic catastrophe, who knows?
But shouldn't that be an issue of ethics itself? I mean, what to fund? What kinds of programs we should be spending our money on?
Absolutely. It's both an issue of good science policy. I mean, what kind of funding for science, public science, what kind of encouragements for the research and development in the private sector are going to be most beneficial for the American economy and for the American people? What are going to lead to jobs? What are going to lead to economic growth in this country? That's very much a value question. And then where you put it, do you put it in health? Do you put it in so-called translational research? Do you put it in basic research? Those are very difficult questions of judgment and value.
Mm-hmm. During the last the debate, Senator Obama and McCain differed, I think, for the first time I'd ever heard it spoken so succinctly about health care, whether it should be a right or it should be an imperative. You know, should it be something that you have a right to or something that is that is something a company can decide to give you or not?
Yeah, I think the question was framed, is healthcare a privilege, a right, or an obligation?
Right.
And Senator McCain answered an obligation. Senator Obama answered a right and then told the very touching story of his mother dying of cancer and fighting with insurance companies. Americans have struggled with this for a long time. In the early, around 1983, I think it was, there was 25 years ago, there was a presidential bioethics commission that started under Carter but finished under Reagan. So by the time the final report, which is what was on access to health care, was written, the commissioners themselves were overwhelmingly Reagan Republicans. They nonetheless said that all Americans, that America as a society has an obligation to make sure that all Americans have access to needed health care. That was a pretty radical statement for that time. I mean, it slipped unnoticed into the world, and no one's acted on it since. But I think, quite frankly, between that kind of genuine, deep social obligation to provide each other with health care and calling it a right, there's not a great deal of difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was a bill. We're gonna talk about this in another program. But there was a bill that was passed last week amid the bailout bill that requires doctors and the healthcare system to treat mental illness on a par with physical illness.
Yes.
And I thought that was, you know, they said it took 12 years to get that, but it seems like an incredible ethical issue here.
Well, people who struggle with mental illness or have people they love in their family who are struggling with mental illness have been fighting this for a very long time. And there's still a bit of a suspicion and stigma associated with mental illness, and this helps to lift it, and it helps to assure that people with mental illness get access to treatment. That's all for the good. More and more clinicians and families and patients understand mental illness as a brain disease. It's not just behaving badly, but it's really a disease.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Charles in Beaufort, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi.
Afternoon to y'all.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
All right. I'd like to follow up on a statement you made earlier about the Reagan administration saying that Congress could get their pertinent science information from lobbyists. And my question is, why can't, hard to put it, maybe nonprofit or positive science corporations lobby the government also? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
It was the caller who said that Reagan, when he dissolved OTA, said that science could rely on lobbyists. I don't remember that, but he dissolved OTA. I don't remember the lobbyist line, but it was a great line. I'm not quite sure what Charles was proposing. I can tell you that there is increasing activity among nonprofits, at least, to try to provide more valid and balanced information to Congress. The Hastings Center is stepping into this arena. We now have something called a bioethics briefing book with analyses of 36 issues that we think are of interest and to policymakers and are likely to be concern for either legislation or regulation in the next Congress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How far down do you think these issues will be for the next president? I think he's going to have a lot to tackle. Do you think that the next president will at least get a presidential advisor on tap pretty quickly?
Well, hope so. That, you know, the first recommendation from the study group at the Center for the Study of the Presidency was that there should be an assistant to the president for science and technology, and that appointment and the head of the other agency, senior science agency, should be among the very first appointments made. I mean, they should already know who they want for those offices, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And they should already begin, they should very quickly begin vetting them.
Mm-hmm. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Tom Murray, president and CEO of the Hastings Center. What's on the top of the Hastings Center list now? What are you most important, do you think?
Well, we're looking at guidelines at the end of life. This is part of health policy. I mean, do we provide adequate support for things like hospice care? Do we have good policy for palliative care? Palliative care isn't just an end-of-life issue, although it is very important at end-of-life. But we've got a fight right now going on between the Office of Drug Policy and doctors who want to be able to use effective and powerful pain control drugs for patients who are suffering. So that's an issue that's up for us. And as I mentioned, synthetic biology we're working on. I work a lot on an issue that I don't think is going to be very high on the president's agenda, and that is the ethics of enhancement technologies. Everything from drugs and sports to gene doping to college students or scientists and engineers taking drugs that they think are cognitive enhancers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's everywhere.
It's
all around us.
It does. I mean, I did have a cup of coffee before I began talking to you, I admit that. And caffeine is a pretty nonspecific and pretty benign drug, but it does affect the brain.
And you know, this being baseball playoff season and World Series, it might be a good time to raise those whole drug-enhancing issues.
When is a bad time to raise it? I mean, we just lived through an Olympics where very few people were caught with drugs, but now they're going back and reanalyzing some of their samples for some of the drugs that they didn't test for initially. We had three cyclists recently eliminated from competition in Europe because of the use of a recent generation blood boosting drug. So yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Sport isn't a metaphor for everything else in life, but it is interesting.
All right, Tom Murray, thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
It's a pleasure, Ira.
You're welcome. Tom Murray, President and CEO of the Hastings Center. It's a nonpartisan bioethics research institute in Garrison, New York. And now it's time for our weekly video pick of the week. What great video do we have up on our website today? And here to tell us about is Flora Lichtman. She is our video producer. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
Got something seasonal for us today?
In fact, we do.
Oh, goody.
This week, we are getting into the fall spirit with a video on pumpkins. Now, okay, that sounds kind of boring, pumpkins.
Right.
But they're no ordinary pumpkins.
They're not.
They're humongous.
As the old Johnny Carson line, how big are they?
Well, the pumpkin that we visit with most in this video is about 1,000 pounds.
Wow.
But that's just the tip of the iceberg. This breed of pumpkins, and it's just a different variety, can get up to, I think the world record is like 1,700 pounds. And, you know, a one-ton pumpkin is on the horizon, I hear.
Wow. And you visited the pumpkin farmer, and we're going to see this giant, humongous pumpkin.
Yes, we visited the farmer, and he told us some of his tricks for growing giant pumpkins.
Wow.
And then we go to a weigh-off, and
that's
where the excitement really starts.
All right, you Halloween folks and pumpkin growers, that's our Science Friday pick of the week at sciencefriday.com. It's there, and you can see the pumpkin video. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks.
That's about all the time we have for today. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Ed Heist. Charles Berquist is our director, and Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Our intern is Molly Ashford. Manya is our technical director this week, and she's at the controls here in New York. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you want to go see our pick of the week at sciencefriday.com, while you're there, you can leave us email. And you can also look at our other videos, dozens of others that Flora has put together, and also send us email from there. And we're blogging and podcasting, and you can actually download those videos right to your, you know, like you do your podcast. We make a podcast out of the video. So that's open to you also. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.